You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Helen Lenski has been criticizing the Olympic industry and exploring gender politics in sport for over a decade. Her past writing credits include Out of Bounds, Women, Sport, and Sexuality, and Olympic Industry Resistance, Challenging Olympic Power and Propaganda. Lenski added the book Gender Politics and the Olympic Industry to her bibliography earlier this year. Published by Palgrave Pivot, the book takes a look at how the Olympic industry treats those involved with the Games, while taking into account the variables of social class, race and ethnicity, sexuality and gender. Helen Lenski is Professor Emerita of the Department of Sociology and Equity Studies at the University of Toronto. She joins me by phone this morning from Toronto. Good morning, Helen, and welcome back to Red Eye.
Thank you. Good morning, Peter.
You document the widespread performance of traditional femininity in the Olympics in your book. Can you explain what this traditional femininity looks like?
Yes. Ever since I started writing about this topic in the early 1980s, I've claimed and documented the ways that any reference to feminine and femininity in the sport context is a code word for heterosexual attractiveness. And that plays itself out particularly graphically in the Olympics because they're a media spectacle above all else.
And why do you think this performance becomes so important for women athletes?
There's so much stigma attached to what is perceived in sort of conservative or even in some liberal circles as crossing a boundary into masculinity. If you're a female athlete, particularly in sports that are considered traditionally male, ways of turning boys into men, in other words. And there are very few sports that are held up as a good route of turning girls into women, whereas all the team sports for boys or martial arts or combat contact sports, they serve that purpose very well. So just by virtue of being in most sports, female Olympic athletes are crossing a boundary, and there's a lot of effort, partly because of the commercialization of sports people, men and women, there's a lot of effort put into presenting a so-called feminine image to the point where historically and today, like for decades, we've had top female athletes around the world, you know, from Western countries primarily, going through all sorts of extremes to make themselves appear feminine, to the point of having plastic surgery on their faces, to having beauty makeovers and so on. Because sex sells sport, and that means heterosexual sex sells sport. And the women who pretty much have to play that game if they want to be world-class athletes aren't going to get to the top unless there's some effort put into their physical appearance. Their sporting achievements don't count for as much if their physical appearance doesn't match up to what are seen as prevailing standards of heterosexual attractiveness.
Who is Caster Semenya?
She is a young South African sprinter who started getting world attention 4 or 5 years back when she was winning world championships and Olympic sprints in not necessarily record-breaking time. She did break some records, but she kind of came out of nowhere, and it was, from what I have researched and documented, it was her appearance above all else that raised suspicions. Now, to make a very long story short, after she was bombarded with all sorts of invasive tests involving gynecologists and sex experts, so-called psychiatrists, and so on, it was determined that she was an intersexed person, which is a very imprecise kind of pseudo-medical term. And then the story was, she's not a real woman, in quotes, and therefore she shouldn't be competing with real women. She isn't eligible because she has too much male hormone, so-called male hormone, which women have in smaller amounts than men, but she was perceived as having too much, therefore an unfair advantage over the, quote, real women, and took the various authorities, the International Athletic Federation and the IOC, about 6 months of this invasive testing and therapy, which involved hormone therapy, to satisfy the powers that be that she was, in fact, a real woman now, or close enough to a real woman that she could compete fairly against other women. There's two very disturbing aspects of this. One is that in future, if the appearance of a female athlete arouses coaches' suspicion or officials' suspicion, all they have to do is send a photograph to the authorities, to the IOC, or the International Federation, and all of this invasive testing will be put into motion to see if the person really is a real woman. And to the point where if she wants to continue to compete against other women, not only the hormone therapy, but in some cases surgery would be required. So all of this is very disturbing, and I'm amazed that there isn't an international outcry about the whole situation. The response has been pretty muted in some quarters where you would expect more outrage.
That sounds like incredible lengths or feats of policing of gender. And in your book, you discuss how the emphasis on femininity leads to eroticization and sexualization of women in sports. How does this happen?
Some of it I would blame the media for, in that the commentary that particularly male TV journalists and print journalists engage in, that commentary often focuses on the sexual, heterosexual attractiveness or lack thereof, in their view, of the women concerned. Sponsors, too, aren't going to have someone like Caster Semenya, who doesn't look like the traditional stereotype of a heterosexually attractive woman. They're not going to give her lucrative sponsorships. And there's another angle on this, which is, again, quite ironic, that because women's sport has such a low profile in most countries, or lower than men's, and lower levels of government funding in most countries, there have been, ever since the early 1990s, female athletes starting, or quite often Olympic athletes, the ones that get the most attention are Olympic athletes, soccer teams, track and field teams, and so on, who pose nude for calendars so that these nude images sell, because sex sells, and naked women sell even better, so that they can raise money for their sport. That's their stated reason, that they say raising their profile, well, that certainly works in that if you take all your clothes off, your profile of that sport or those bodies is going to be raised, but raising money because through the selling calendars at $20 or $30 or whatever, because the sport is underfunded. I, of course, would say that that's an ill-advised way of raising the profile or raising money.
And how does the sexualization in turn affect policy at the Olympics?
There are a lot of sports that have a dress code, and beach volleyball is the classic example, where the uniform has to be a maximum size, covering as little of the body as possible. So those women are wearing their sport bikinis, although in an interesting twist during before the 2012 London Olympics, the International Sport Beach Volleyball Federation changed the rules slightly so that women could wear tank tops or T-shirts and shorts rather than the sport bikini. And their only reason was the eyes of the world were upon this big move to get Islamic countries, particularly particularly in the Middle East, in the Saudi Arabians and so on, to get those countries to send at least one female athlete to the Games, and partly to involve more countries, which was a good move in itself. The beach volleyball people had regional contests around Europe and Asia, and countries that typically didn't send female teams. So they knew they couldn't sort of have their cake and eat it, that if they wanted to improve their image by having more women from these underrepresented countries, particularly Muslim women, they want to have more of them in the Olympics. They can't insist on a dress code where 90% of the female body is skin and not covered with clothing. So there was that change, but the bottom line really is that the more the sport, the female athletes can be used as a vehicle to sell the sport through sex, the better as far as the IOC and the sponsors go.
And then on the other level, many critics of the Olympics talk about gender parity or an equal playing field as a worthwhile goal. How far do you think that goal would be able to redress the inequities present in the Olympic industry?
Not as much as liberal sport feminists would have us believe. Often the stated agenda of liberal sport feminists is simply to gain parity, as if equal numbers is all that's needed, and that, as if to assume that there's absolutely nothing wrong with the practice of international sport in the hands of the IOC and the international federations. And I've documented in all of my Olympic books and my women's sport, the two other books on women's sport, I've documented the extensive list of shortcomings and actual dangers to women of trying to join the men's game instead of, in some cases, developing a game of our own. And in the early 20s, in the early 1920s, there was, in fact, the Women's Olympics. They weren't allowed to use the word Olympic very long. The IOC said they had to change it, so they called it the Women's Games. But these were in the hands, exclusively in the hands of women, with some supportive male sport administrators on their side, and going into bat for them with the IOC and international federations. But these were women's sports, and there was for a few years, there were more events and more athletes and more spectators at the Women's Olympics than at the so-called real Olympics.
Wow. That's definitely a little-known history.
Yeah, this is something that I've focused on in the book, of going back for the 100-plus years of Olympic history and showing that it's not the only game in town, that there have been Women's Olympics. There are still Workers' Olympics, well, Workers' Games. There are the Maccabean Games in Israel. There are the Gay Games for LGBTQ people. There's Asian Games, African Games, Aboriginal Games, Indigenous Games. There's a lot of other international sporting events that don't have the same negative history, the same history of excluding certain groups, the same history of commercialization, professionalism, and so on.
In the book, you discuss how athletes end up embodying national identities. How does that interact with the treatment of women's bodies in sport?
There's been quite a few examples over the history of the Olympics where not just totalitarian regimes, but Western countries, democratic countries as well, have latched on to a particular successful female athlete and used her as the kind of icon of femininity for their country. It certainly happened in Nazi Germany. It happened in fascist Italy. Chinese do it from time to time, Russians and so on. But Western countries have also sort of got their poster girls of Canadian, American, Australian, British femininity, and exploiting those kinds of images purely for nationalist purposes.
I want to just ask you briefly about how this all comes down to, say, the today's Olympics, and I know the sensitivity of the Olympic logo was something that protest groups often spoke about leading up to the games. And in your book, you mentioned the historical presence of protest and watchdog groups. How much impact do you think these groups have in changing the Olympic industry?
Well, there's two angles on that, and one is that, as I just mentioned, some of the protest groups have realized that they'd be much better off organizing an alternative games on their own terms, by and for the disadvantaged people. Not always a minority, since women are not a minority in the same way as indigenous people. And then the more recent protests of the last, since the early 1980s, probably since the Montreal Games as well, the watchdog groups and the protest groups and anti-Olympic groups have in some cases brought public attention to the real costs of hosting a game, so that bids become less popular because there's another narrative, there's another set of facts and figures getting put out there through the media about the real costs, and in contrast to the propaganda that bid committees put out. And then the organizers and local politicians, for instance in Vancouver, know that there's a very visible, very vocal coalition of Olympic watchdog groups representing homeless people, native people, environmental groups, low-income people, who are watching every move, documenting it through social media, talking to mainstream journalists, doing a lot of grassroots activist work to make sure that the Olympic industry propaganda machine doesn't dominate the airwaves.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Helen, and we definitely recommend your book.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I've been speaking to Helen Lenski. Helen is the author of Gender Politics and the Olympic Industry.